Today on Wings.
Can you really say a democracy is healthy if its parliamentary institutions members are so unrepresentative of the people they're supposed to be representing?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The movement to increase women's representation in governing bodies has been at work for generations, and some progress has been made. But the Interparliamentary Union, which tracks national statistics for 193 countries, said in 2021 that progress had essentially stagnated. As of March 1, 2022, only 5 countries had 50% women or more in their lower house of Congress or Parliament: Rwanda, Cuba, Nicaragua, Mexico, and the United Arab Emirates. The UK was in 45th place for percentage of women in its parliament, Australia 57th place, and Canada ranked 59th. Why? Canadian political scientist Dr. Jeanette Ash is a specialist in this question. After Canada's 2021 federal election, Ash appeared in a series of podcasts for Rabble Radio with interviewer Libby Davies, herself recently retired from Parliament as deputy leader of Canada's New Democratic Party.
Thank you so much for joining me, Jeanette Ash. I know that you're the chair of the Political Science Department at Douglas College. You're well published. You do a lot of research about how we're doing in terms of gender representation in the political arena, but also diversity overall in Canada's Parliament. And I thought we could begin by reflecting on the recent federal election. There's 103 women who were elected to the House of Commons, so we finally hit the 30% representation of the whole parliament, up slightly from 29% from the 2019 election. And of the 49 new members of parliament, 22 are women.
So up from 29% to 30%. Women, the election before that, it was 2015. What was the percentage? 26%. The election before that, it was 25%. So over the last 4 elections or so, we've only seen an increase of a few percentage points.
So those are the numbers. But of course, what's interesting is what is behind the numbers.
There is a myth that women and other equity deserving groups don't come forward. You know, they don't seek candidacy. So there's a real blame placed on the underrepresented group. But if you really look at it closely, you have to look at the gatekeepers to the corridors of power. So the gatekeepers to office in a parliamentary system like Canada, where parties are so strong, are the parties. So it's the parties' selection processes that are really keeping equity deserving groups like women and like people who identify as Indigenous or Black or people of color or LGBTQ as plus out of those powerful positions. So a lot of the research that I've done focuses on this and works to dispel that myth that blames the underrepresented group. So if you look at all of the people who actually apply to become a candidate for a political party, and then you look at the people who are actually selected by party members as the official candidate to stand in election, you'll see that they don't really match up. There's a disproportional number of men getting through compared to women. And this is especially the case in winnable seats. So in parties' target seats and parties' winnable seats. So we might have record number of women standing for office. We see parties putting in more effort to recruit women. So that is good. But we really, really haven't seen a huge improvement, especially in terms of being elected.
Do you see it primarily as a party allowing systemic barriers and obstacles to stay in place, the status quo, the old, you know, the old boys club?
So if you pull back the curtains on party selection processes, where we do see women getting selected, they're not getting selected at the same rates in winnable or target seats as men. And one of the reasons for this is party members can only choose one candidate to represent their party in an electoral district. And by default, they often will select the person that most resembles who has historically been successful in the past. And of course, if you look at our parliaments, they historically comprised, initially 100% of white professional straight men. So they think, okay, we have one chance at getting our candidate elected. So we ought to choose the person who most looks like the successful politician, the sort of standard model candidate. And so that's what they tend to do. And I've done studies where with everything held equal, so women and men having the same kinds of political experience, education levels, all that kind of thing, party members are up to 5 times more likely to choose a man in a winnable seat or a safe seat over a woman or than a woman. And that's quite striking. And to me, that says that's an institutional bias at the party level where party members are probably not even aware that they're doing this.
For the women who are running, is part of the barrier the response of the electorate?
There's been research that shows that the electorate does not discriminate against women candidates. In fact, there's a slight bias towards women candidates. And some parties in some countries have clued into this and they see, okay, there might actually be an electoral advantage to selecting more women in target and winnable seats because the electorate actually likes them. So this is it's kind of a wake-up call, I think. And we really have to address this. One way is to formally encourage parties. You can incentivize parties, or you could, penalize parties for not selecting a certain percentage of women or people from other equity deserving groups. And this could be in the form of a sex quota, where you create an artificial demand temporarily. So we do get that boost in the percentage.
Has that been done anywhere?
In Canada, where we see that is in British Columbia, the BC legislature, the BC New Democratic Party has had in place an equity mandate for several years, and that has resulted in the BC NDP having a caucus that is a majority women. There was initially a lot of resistance to the equity mandate, but now the results are celebrated. And the policy itself is celebrated too. And in New Brunswick recently has in place a policy to incentivize parties to select more women candidates as well. But other than that, there's no formal measures in place to ensure parties select 50% women candidates in safe seats. There was an attempt federally, Bill 237, the Gender Equity Elections Canada Act, that was proposed. It was a private member's bill by Kennedy Stewart, which I worked on, and alongside me, many, many academics from across Canada and in Ireland and in the UK. So we had a lot of organizations behind this, and this bill did fail, and the bill has been successful in other countries, like a similar type of policy has been successful in Ireland and in France, for example. And it it's not a quota, but what it does is encourages parties to select more women and people from equity deserving groups. If they do, then they won't lose some of their public subsidy because parties are publicly subsidized. You know.
I'd like to continue our conversation by hearing more about the research you have completed and the research that's still underway. I know you've looked at the BC legislature and how to make it gender sensitive. What does that mean, gender sensitive?
It's multifaceted, but some of the criteria include the following. A gender sensitive parliament is a place that promotes and achieves equality in the numbers of women and men across all of its bodies and internal structures. And when I say women, I'm also including people who identify as women. So I'm considering intersectionality as well. A gender-sensitive parliament mainstreams gender equality through all of its work. A gender-sensitive parliament fosters an internal culture that respects women's rights and promotes gender equality. It is a place that respects the needs and realities for balance, work-life balance, family responsibilities for men and women. And a gender-sensitive parliament is one that extends beyond members. It also considers parliamentary staff, legislative staff, and equips them with the capacity and resources needed to promote gender equality, recruiting, and also having retention of women in senior positions. So those are some of the criteria from the Interparliamentary Union, which does a lot of work on gender sensitizing parliaments. And there are actually more criteria, but these are just some. Parliaments are workplaces for members, but also for many, many staff. So parliamentary, legislative staff, party staff. So when we're thinking of these places, we've got to think of them as places of work. And what should a place of work be like? What is a place of work that is gender sensitive and diversity sensitive? A place where people go and where they feel welcome, where they feel like they belong, where they feel safe, where they feel they can equally participate. I've done a little bit of work on this with the BC legislature initially. I've used the BC legislature as a case study, and it's the first of its kind in Canada. And there's many phases to a gender sensitive assessment. So I've started the first few steps in BC and published a report. It's online. It's called Assessing Gender and Diversity Sensitivity at the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia. And this report was prepared for the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians Canadian region. So you can find that online, and you can find more details about what a gender-sensitive parliament is, what it looks like, and some of my initial findings. So one of the steps of a gender-sensitive parliament that I did do in BC is to get the clerk's office to fill out a checklist to determine how ready a parliament, a legislature, is to undertake a gender-sensitive assessment, because it is a big undertaking. And so you have to find out if they have the kind of data that are required to do a gender-sensitive assessment. And if you go to the report that you can find online, you'll see that there's 68 initial questions that were filled in by the clerk's office. And of those 68 questions, they only were collecting data on 11 of the kinds of things that you needed data on. So they don't really collect data on things like representation on committees, or there's no requirement, for example, for the legislature to debate the importance of gender diversity at all. So there's a lot of room for improvement. Now, I should say that BC comparatively isn't doing badly. I mean, 43% of the legislators in BC are women. There's one party, the BC-NDP, that has over 50% women in its caucus. It's a very diverse legislature, more diverse than it's ever been. The head clerk is a woman, Kate Ryan Lloyd. The speaker, Raj Johan, for example, is from an equity deserving group. And so there's been lots of steps towards gender sensitivity. They're undertaking a workplace review, but again, there's a lot of room for improvement.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from the podcast series Rabble Radio. Here's Breanne Doyle, who is managing editor of the media outlet Rabble.ca and the producer of Rabble Radio, with more about the interviewee and the interviewer featured in our program today.
Dr. Jeanette Ash is the chair of the Political Science Department at Douglas College. She's also a visiting faculty member at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, King's College London. Her research interests include political recruitment, political parties, representation, and gender in politics. She is the author of Political Candidate Selection, Who Wins, Who Loses, and Underrepresentation in the UK. Other recent publications include Gender Sensitivity Under Trudeau, Facebook Feminism or Real Change, and Canada's Political Parties, Gatekeepers to Parliament. Dr. Ash advises legislatures, parties, and organizations on assessing gender and diversity sensitivity. She also advises legislators on drafting legislation on gender equity and democratic reform. Libby Davies is the author of Outside In, a Political Memoir. She served as the MP for Vancouver East from 1997 to 2015 and is former NDP Deputy Leader and House Leader. Libby is also the recipient of the Order of Canada.
Welcome back, Jeanette. I'd like to continue our conversation by hearing what you recommend to make the BC legislature gender sensitive.
I've been undertaking ongoing interviews with the staff and members there. And when we think about people, when they get elected to a place, we have to consider what happens to them. And I'm hearing a lot of things that reflect what members of other legislatures are saying. It's like the heckling is a problem. A lot of women feel that they don't really belong there. They don't feel welcome. So a lot of women are reporting that they're not getting promoted at the same rates as men. But again, we need the data, the diversity data on this. Some women are reporting that they don't feel safe places. Some report that the rules are really archaic and old, and they reflect the legislature as it was when it was built. It was a place that was built by men, for men, and not a lot of the institutional features of the place have changed. So it's still very much like a masculine place with a masculine culture. And, you know, this is kind of embedded in its practices and its rules. So when we talk about a gender-sensitive parliament, we have to talk about identifying what those gender-insensitive rules are, those gender-insensitive practices are, the sort of masculine cultural features of it. And we've got to change those, and we have to institutionalize those changes. So it's not just about informally doing things differently. It's about implementing these changes. And it shouldn't be done just by a few champions of gender diversity. So it's not the responsibility of, you know, the parliamentary secretary for gender equity. It's not the responsibility of a handful of women in the Women's Caucus. It's the responsibility of everybody there. It's all members and staff and parliament or the legislatures itself. Like, it has to be institutionally changed.
That tells us how complex this work is. So I'd like to move beyond the BC legislature, which, as you said, was a case study, because I know you're also doing work at the national level with MPs and staff. What have you learned from that? And particularly the issue of the hybrid parliament that we've seen in the last couple of years.
So the case study of the BC legislature, that kind of paved way for doing a larger assessment, a more fulsome assessment through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. And I've been asked now to look at the national legislature, so the House of Commons and the Senate, and parliaments, legislatures across Canada. So I'm undertaking the next steps of the BC legislature gender sensitivity parliamentary review, in addition to focusing on Manitoba and Quebec and Prince Edward Island, and as I said, the National House of Commons and the Senate. I'm finding some very interesting things. This is ongoing, this work. So I'm interviewing members, and there's also a survey that's being sent out. I'm getting responses now. Some of the feedback that I've been getting amongst women anyways is the impact that things like heckling, so verbal harassment, it has on them. This is something that I'm seeing in all the legislatures. And if they complain that heckling is really upsetting, they're told, you know, to toughen up, that this is part of politics and this is what they should expect. But this is the very thing that indicates a parliament is not a gender sensitive place. So to be told that heckling is a part of it, to expect heckling and not to complain about heckling, is something that reinforces this really sort of toxic masculine culture in parliament. One of the things that is coming through in the surveys and the interviews that I ask about is the experiences with hybridity. So one of the things that have come out of the pandemic is parliaments across the world, including Canada, they've been disrupted. So the workplace has been disrupted, like all of our workplaces, and they've had to adapt. And one of the ways that adaptation has taken place is to move parliament online. So this allows members to participate virtually from home in terms of recorded divisions and also committee work. And there's been varied responses to this. So at the national level, they passed a bill in the fall that is allowing members of parliament to engage with hybridity so they can work from home in terms of recorded divisions or committee work, or they can work face-to-face. It's up to them. And I think that's in place until spring 2022, and it'll be revisited. Some of the provincial legislatures have also engaged with hybridity, not all of them. Some of them have, BC has as well. But what we've seen happening provincially is that it hasn't been continued. So members can still participate virtually, but they have to have a reason. They have to be ill. Otherwise, they're expected to be there. Now, nationally and in the provinces, what I've been finding is there's this real nervousness about, well, what if we'll always have to be face-to-face? And when people have experienced this staying at home and being able to vote, it's allowed them to more fully participate. And I see this especially with women and people with members with young children, staff as well, saying that the ability to vote from home, especially when they're caring for elders or for people who are ill in their family or children, for example, has allowed them to more fulsomely participate. They can vote. And there's, again, this real worry that if it's mandated that they have to go face-to-face sort of permanently, that they might not reoffer themselves. So they might not seek re-election. And this is the problem, because we have already a problem in terms of retention of women members. We see higher turnover of women members. So if we've come up with a solution to make a parliament more gender sensitive, and the technology is already there, and if it means that people are going to stay in their job, why not keep it? This is kind of a win-win situation. I want to say, though, it's not the same for all. Some people don't like it. They like the energy of being face-to-face. And one thing to consider, too, is the impact it has on staff. Some staff like it because, again, they can participate more fully if they have other responsibilities. But some staff have said that it's actually made their workload a lot more. We might be stuck inside and not able to do the work from home, but we're expected to extend our hours to serve the members. Another aspect, though, of the hybrid parliament is that I've been hearing from especially younger women members and women members who identify as Indigenous or Black as a person of color, that it has made the experience of being a legislator safer. It's made them feel more comfortable. And one reason for this is that there is no heckling. If another member is heckling them, then they can be muted. And members are generally muted unless they're, you know, talking. So the experience of heckling has gone way down, and it's made working more pleasant. And when you think about these places as workplaces, in what other workplace is it okay to scream at your colleagues and to call them names or to undermine them? And a lot of this is really gender-based, right? There's also of course, there's no instances of face-to-face intimidation or other forms of harassment that we see. Despite legislatures trying to improve upon their codes of conduct, Me Too has come to parliaments across Canada for sure. And more people are researching violence against women in politics. And in all of the interviews I've done with women, all of them have shared incidences of harassment in one way or another that they've received from other members of their legislative assemblies or members of parliament who harass them, who intimidate them, who bully them. Again, a lot of this is gender-based. It's not right. It shouldn't be taking place, but it does. The way to follow up on this is problematic as well. So the harassment policies across Canada need to still be improved.
That is an incredibly significant finding that you've come across with the hybrid parliament and the responses that you got, which leads me to my last question, really, and that is how important this research is so that we actually can get the data, get the experiences, both the objective and the subjective experiences. So how much of this work is being undertaken elsewhere? Are you on your own doing this work, or are there other parliaments in other countries looking at this kind of issue as well?
I am far from alone, and all of the work I do on this, I'm building on the work of other gender and politics scholars and researchers and other organizations. If it wasn't for the work that they've done already and that they are doing, I wouldn't be doing this work at all. This work is very, very much inspired by the work of Professor Sarah Childs, who did the real first fulsome gender sensitive assessments of the British Parliament. She did that in 2016, and you can go online and see it. It's called The Good Parliament. It's amazing. She came up with 43 recommendations of how to make the good parliament more gender sensitive. So my work very, very much builds on Sarah Child's work. And she has been incredibly supportive in the work that I've been doing in Canada and has been sort of a champion of this work and has encouraged it from the get-go. This work also builds on the work of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association and Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians, who have been doing work on women's political equality in Commonwealth countries for over 20 years. And it also builds on the work of the Interparliamentary Union, who have been doing this work for over a decade as well, and has put together a gender assessment toolkit. So you can go online and see the Interparliamentary Union's gender assessment toolkit. And this is the toolkit that the IPU encourages all parliaments to look at. And they really encourage all parliaments to undertake an internal gender parliamentary assessment review. And you can see the list of countries that have done it. Right now, I am doing some more work for the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. They have asked me to do a field guide that all Commonwealth parliaments will be encouraged to look at. And I'm just completing that right now. 7 steps to a gender-sensitive parliament. So I've come up with the 7 steps assessment, and it should be coming out soon.
That is fantastic to hear. I mean, there's just so much work that you've undertaken. And I get the sense that you are optimistic that there will be follow-up, that your work has been received very well, because of course it's resonating with the experience that all of these equity-seeking groups have. So it sounds like you're optimistic that there will be follow-up.
Oh, absolutely. Gender sensitizing parliaments undertaking assessment, or at least talking about an assessment, is becoming more of a norm now, an international norm. And parliaments look at what other parliaments are doing. One of the measures of a gender sensitive parliament is having equal numbers of women and men in legislative bodies and also within staff, within senior positions as well. A lot of parliaments are looking at how they can work toward this. And I should say, a really important part of gender sensitizing the parliament is to institutionalize the gender sensitivity recommendations. And this is done by assigning any recommendation to a particular person, like, for example, to a speaker. And the speaker has a good deal of authority in terms of implementing gender sensitivity recommendations. One of the things that came out of Sarah Child's The Good Parliament is proxy voting. And proxy voting is now being trialed in the UK. And it's very, very welcome indeed. For example, a woman member of parliament was scheduled to have a C-section and she had to be present for the recorded division. I mean, there's no ifs and or buts, and she had to be there. It was a very close vote. And so she showed up for the recorded division in a wheelchair, about to have a C-section. Just so she could vote. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So shortly after that, and with a lot of pressure, and this is one of many, many instances, with a lot of pressure, the British Parliament is now trialing proxy voting. So you don't have to be physically present to cast your vote. You can get somebody to act as a proxy for you. And so this, of course, has caught wind across other jurisdictions. And now Canada's National Parliament is looking into proxy voting and other kinds of policy changes, small policy changes that would make a huge difference. So you don't have women showing up to vote just moments away of having a C-section and having to postpone that C-section of all things. So small things like that. There's quite a few examples, but that's one. And I think that we'll see more parliaments revisiting or looking at this in more detail.
Well, that's a very dramatic example and a very good example of why things need to change. Jeanette, we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you so much for all the information that you shared today.
Okay, thank you, Libby. And I should just say, I feel like I should be interviewing you about this.
It's a good conversation.
You were there.
It's a good conversation. Yeah.
That was Canadian political scientist, Dr. Jeanette Ash, interviewed by retired member of Canada's Parliament, Libby Davies. Their remarks were excerpted from three episodes of the podcast series Rebel Radio, which can be found through the website rebel.ca. By the way, in case you were wondering, in the Interparliamentary Union statistics on percentages of women in the world's parliaments, the U.S. is tied for 72nd place with the Dominican Republic. Russia is 137th. Find the complete rankings at data.ipu.org. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio for a link to recent archives. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found at gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.